You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody to Here District. I'm the captain of this vessel, Marcus Johnson, Captain Johnson, and my first mate, Chris Johnson, my son, the only father and son tandem to win a national championship at the same school, 20 years apart. I got my UCLA polo on. You see that logo, Chris?
Nice.
That's that old school. That's that old school Under Armour. We had to get rid of that.
But we'll talk more about you. We got to update you.
That's my hope that the UCLA brass will see that and send us a whole bunch of gear with the whole Nike thing going on. But, man, look, let's introduce our guest. Ramona Shelburne is a senior writer, senior NBA writer for ESPN. And welcome to Here District, Ramona, first of all.
What's up? You got it. Blessed to be on with like two LA legends, man. I follow both of your careers forever.
Well, we appreciate that. And just digging into your background a bit. I mean, we were talking before the show started. I mean, you've got some pretty strong UCLA roots yourself, young lady.
I do. Yeah. You know, my parents met at UCLA. My dad was he worked at Westward Ho Market over there. You know where that is, Mark?
Sure, of course.
He worked at Westward Ho
Boulevard. Yeah. Oh, of course.
And my mom was a dance major. And so she was like young and hot. And he was a grocery store checker and he was really good at it. And he turned to her and he goes, don't I know you from somewhere? And she's like, oh, I mean, we both go to UCLA. And I was like, oh, what a line, Dad. Okay. That's a great line. So that's where I come from.
Was he like a young grocery checker at Westwood Ho? Was he older, senior? Yeah. And she was younger?
No, he was, I think he's 2 years older than my mom. So he was, and he was just a little, he's from Bakersfield. So he went to South High in Bakersfield and had to like work to put himself through college. So like he didn't have any money. He's like drove down from Bakersfield, slept in his car the first week of school and like he had to get jobs. And so like this was his job. He was really good at being a grocery store bagger. And like that's how he met my mom. Because like here comes this hot chick coming in. And I guess he just shot, I guess, you know.
Hey, you only live once.
Right. All she can say is no. Now you're the only child.
I have a younger brother.
Okay. Yeah, and then from West Hills.
My brother Marshall. West Hills. So I'm out in the valley.
You played some softball at El Camino Real High School.
El Camino Real.
Okay.
And then we were the Conquistadors, but they changed their name now to the Royals. I played softball, graduated in 1997. So we kind of, Chris and I think we overlapped a little bit. I was always reading about you in the LA Times. Plus my parents were like Bruins. So like then the UCLA connection. My dad would always talk about you, Marcus. Okay. And so I know the whole, like, I was a huge UCLA fan growing up. Like, you know, all you guys would know, Toby Bailey, right? You know, Tyus Edney. All the O'Bannons, you know?
Yeah, Tyus Edney's actually a cousin of ours. We say that pretty much every single show. Yeah, yeah, he's
Point four. I mean, I'll never forget that against Missouri.
Found out at a family reunion. People came up to me. You got to get a cousin going to UCLA. I was like, bring him over. They brought over this little tiny dude. I was like, yeah, whatever, okay.
And then we're related.
I didn't think much of it. You know, Long Beach Poly. I knew UCLA Jim Harris. Yeah. He was going to be good, but then he played against I think Indiana his freshman year and kind of turned the whole game around with his speed. Oh, yeah. And I'm like, that's my cousin. I start claiming
there
him after that. So
but
before I was kind of off him, like, whatever. But anyway.
Chris, who'd you play with at Crenshaw? You played with a couple guys in high school.
Tremaine Folks was one. Tremaine ended up being drafted by the Nuggets, was Pac-12 freshman of the year at Cal. Yeah, so he was a high-flying leaper. A bunch of guys that made it D1 and continued to play professionally overseas and stuff like that.
Yeah, and you guys won state, right? That's what I remember following you last one.
Back to back.
Two-time state champions, two-time city. It was a great run, Ramon. If you remember, it was a dominant run.
I do remember.
Run.
That's.
I mean, it was a dominant run. I can't lie. I'm so glad you can vouch for that because
I totally vouch for it. I read about it in the LA. You guys were like always in the LA Times. So I was always, and I was reading it back then because that's what we did back then, right? We followed it, all the hot teams.
Heck yeah. Talk about Ramona real quick. Growing up in L.A., right? You know, we grew up in L.A. In the backdrop of, you know, the Lakers, the Dodgers, championship organizations. How much did the voices of like the Lakers, the Dodgers, or the legends of the L.A. Times, a Jim Murray or Alan Malamud, how much did these people in L.A. inspire you to become a sports writer?
I mean, I grew up reading the LA Times, right? So it's funny. I do shows with Bill Plaschke now, and I'm like, I grew up reading you. He's like, stop saying that. It made me feel really old. I used to read all those, Jim Murray and Eric Sondheimer, by the way. We got to give a shout out to Eric Sondheimer, right?
No question.
He's been doing it forever.
Well, I didn't talk to Sondy for a number of years because after we got upset by Idaho State, my senior year, which Chris never let me live down for years until they lost to Princeton. But Eric Sondheimer, he blasted me in a column. Didn't really blast me, but just kind of criticized my lack of whatever. But he didn't know when we had lost that game, I had a wisdom tooth, impacted wisdom tooth that had to be chiseled out of my jaw that morning. And I was on meds supposed to play. I think I had 20 in the first half and 1 point in the second half, but I just ran out of gas. But he talked about me. So I didn't talk to Eric for a long time. It was actually Michael Sondheimer. It was actually Michael Sondheimer, the brother that we didn't talk for a while.
Ramona, quick trivia question. Do you know where Eric got his kind of first beat, where he got his start covering, who he covered? Do you know who it is?
Well, he started at the Daily News, right? Eric was originally the Daily News.
And it was an athlete, big time guy, dual sport. You should know
John
this.
John Elway.
There you go.
Is it right? Was it? Granada Hill? Was it?
John Elway, Granada, baby. Good job.
I know my Valley history. Listen, I started at the Daily News. So I had a, I took on one, it was like this day, and I would pick, like, I'd go in the Daily News archives and I would just search 1987, 1973, and I'd be like, whatever the date was. And I would find some, like, you know, callback. And that was like one of my things that I used to do. So I know everything from like way back. Like, I remember when I was writing about Drew Holiday. And I went up to his mom and I go, Hey, I was writing about you when you were at San Fernando High and you were a track star. And then like, I know Toya, right? That's because I had looked her up from 19, whatever she went, I don't know what year it was, but she was like a star herself. And so I know almost every athlete from the San Fernando Valley, just because I used to do that feature that we had in the Daily News. So anybody good, I could almost tell you whatever the name of their high school was.
We'll talk about things coming full circle. So Chris started out at Montclair Prep High School.
It doesn't exist anymore.
But that's where Michael Jackson, Cher, the Kardashians, Eddie Cibrian,
Josiah Johnson.
But that's where everybody went before Sierra Canyon.
Exactly. It had a boarding school, so we had some foreign students on camp. But the thing is, Ramona, is that in the league championship, they were ineligible his freshman year or sophomore year.
Eric Sondheimer wrote a lot of those stories, I remember.
But they played, so their championship was against Cabo Hall. They had a player by the name of Alex Lopez. He's the older brother of Brooke and Robin Lopez. Brooke and Robin would be on the sidelines at 3 years old, running like about 5 feet tall with these Geronimos on overalls.
And their afros. They had these cute afros.
The big blonde afros, the cutest little things. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we just go way back. So anyway, I digress. But let's talk about your journey as a writer. The first thing that stood out to me, I mean, you're not only a great journalist, writer, all that good stuff. But I mean, you're an athlete. So you went to Stanford.
Yeah.
I read a piece that you did at Stanford where you talked about.
Look at you.
I won't say struggle, but the challenge is a better word. Yeah. I mean, because you didn't want people to know that you were an athlete. A lot of people thought you got into Stanford just because you were an athlete, but you were valedictorian in high school also?
Yeah, all that good stuff.
Yeah. So, but just talk about how you wound up at Stanford as opposed to going to UCLA.
I know. I did always want to go to UCLA when I was growing up because that's where my parents went. And also UCLA was the best in softball. Like Sue Enquist had that rolling, right? So you go from Dr. Dot, then you go to Lisa Fernandez. I mean, all the goats in softball, right? I remember I still have this, okay? So I was a sophomore in high school And they, and I got a note from UCLA softball, and it was like, "Hi Ramona, we followed your progress closely this year in high school and are going to monitor your monitor your career going forward. We're very impressed. Keep it up," you know? And I was like, "Oh, you know who I am. Oh my God." And all it was like, "You're on our list," right? Like, it wasn't like, "You're going to be our UCLA." And I thought it was probably because, like, when back then I played in the city section. So when the city section had their city championships, we played at Easton Stadium. So probably like I played at Easton Stadium and I don't know if they saw the roster or whatever. Right. And it's like one of my prized possessions at UCLA. And I was on the radar. Wow. And then I never heard from them again. That's okay. But the truth is, like, so you get like sophomore year, you're thinking about a lot of things. And then I took a class, a summer school class at UCLA that summer. And I was like super academic. I took all the AP classes and stuff. So this was like a way of like, let's take a college class. And I drove over, I just got my driver's license and I drove over there every day on the 405, not, a couple times a week, whatever it was. And I thought to myself, and I was like, I had fun, but I also felt like, man, if I go to UCLA, this is what, I'm never going to leave. I'm just going to live at home with my folks and then drive on the 405 every day. And I was like, I want that college experience. Like, and the only way to really have that is if I leave. I can't just stay home and I feel like I need to grow. I need to push myself a little bit. And so that's really when I started looking outside of LA. Like, I didn't want to go too far, but I wanted to open it up and like just kind of open my mind a little, because I know how I am. I'm really close to my folks. I was really close to my family. And if I was just here, it would be too easy to stay. It would be too easy to just not grow. And so that's when, so my junior year, I played on a travel softball team. And that's where in softball, that's kind of how you get recruited, is travel ball. And all the girls on my team were older than me. Like, I was the young one and they were all the class above me, which I always recommend. I always think it's, I mean, everybody says like, oh, you should be the big fish in a small pond. I'm like, no, you should play up, challenge yourself. But I guess it depends on your maturity level or how you can handle things or whatever. But I liked playing up. And the girls that I played with, they all graduated and went off to college. And I was like, oh, wait, this sucks. I'm the only one still left on the team. There was like me and one other girl. And so then I had to kind of find a new team my senior year, which was really awkward. And I had, you know, kind of already been recruited a little bit, but not, I wasn't like big time recruit or anything. It was just sort of, you send your stuff out, people write you back. And so that senior year I went and played I played a team called Stealth. So I was on the older team, and then I went and played with the younger team of them. And we had a girl on that team by the name of Jessica Mendoza.
Yes.
You might have heard of her. She works for ESPN. She's a two-time Olympian, three-time Olympian, something
big
like
time,
that.
Big time, big time.
Yeah, she ended up being my teammate at Stanford, but I was a year older than her. And so I remember I was just playing just to get seen that fall. Like, I needed to, like, the teams that were watching me, like, needed to come say, like, hey, can we see you play? And so I didn't really want to play that fall because I was, you know, my team was gone, but I was like, all right, whatever. So I played everywhere. I played first base, which is funny because I'm like 5'2". I don't play first, I'm an outfielder, you know? But I was like, whatever, I just need to get seen. Okay. So I played infield, I played outfield, played first base, catcher, whatever. And I remember the Stanford coaches were going to come down and watch me play. And I was like, look, I don't know what position I'm going to play. Does that matter to you? And they were like, nah, it's okay. We just want to see you out there and hitting, whatever. And I go, okay, good. Because you need to see this girl on our team. Like, there's this girl that I play with, and she's like the best player I've ever seen. And, like, she had told me, and I go, and she swears she wants to go to Stanford. I'm like, there's no way. I would have never thought she would go to Stanford, because she should be UCLA, Arizona, top teams, whatever.
Sure.
But she kept asking me about Stanford. And I was like, really? Are you sure? Is that where you want to go? She goes, it's my dream. So I told my coach, I go, hey, like, this girl says she wants to go to Stanford. I think you can get her. Like, she's so good. And so I played fine. But then they saw her and they were like, whoa, you're right. And I don't know if it helped me get in or helped them want me, but like, I don't know, like, whatever it was.
It didn't,
like,
hurt.
That's how they got in on Mendoza. Like, no, like, they had a chance. And so I'd like to take credit for that. And she usually lets me, you know. So that was good recruiting right there. But anyway, that's ended up, I ended up taking recruiting trips everywhere. I took a trip to Michigan. Took a trip to Harvard, took a trip to Yale, a trip to Cal, and then Stanford. And then I went, like, you know, I really wanted to go back east, but I just, I don't know, I'm too close to my family. Like, I was too, like, if I go to Boston and I play there, I'm just going to end up living there my life. You know, I'm going to be like, I'm going to meet somebody there. I'll get married. I'll get a job there. And then all of a sudden I'll come home twice a year on Thanksgiving and my birthday. I mean, I was like, nah, I need to stay close. So that's how I ended up back at Stanford. And it was going to be Stanford over Cal. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. But quick story. So
take a little shot at Cal. Just a little puff.
Yeah. That's okay. You have to. But quick story. So you just reminded me. Now, my family was always a tradition. My parents moved from Louisiana down south because they wanted us to get better academic opportunities. They wanted us to all go to UC school. So we all did and graduated. My two older sisters went to UC Santa Barbara. So it was a tradition where we would drop off the prospective freshmen, drive them up, unpack them, get them settled, and cry and tears and snot going everywhere. So when I went to UCLA, they did the same thing for me. They drove me out to UCLA, to Westwood, unpacked my Volvo, crying tears and all that. My parents went to a Fedco or some store to pick up some stuff. By the time they got back home, I was sitting in the living room like, hey, what's for dinner? You know, like, wait, boy, what are you doing here? We just dropped you off like an hour ago. I'm like, hey, I was right back home within an hour after they had dropped me off because
I relate, honestly.
You know,
like when you're really close to your family, like, okay, so so I went to Stanford and my mom took me, we made a trip out of the drive up. So we loaded up the van and we drove up and we were like, let's make a car trip. So we stopped in Pismo Beach the first night from LA. And then on the second night we went to San Francisco, we drove all the way to San Francisco. And, but we like kind of, you know, stopped and had a couple of nice adventures. Every year we would drive up like that and bring all my stuff. And the first time my parents left, I was like standing there until the last second they were out of view, you know, and I was like crying my eyes out. Meanwhile, like most of the people I was there, they were so excited their parents were leaving. Like they were excited for the freedom. And I was like bawling my eyes out.
I was that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were that
excited
guy
for the freedom.
And like, I went back for Thanksgiving. And I remember I was so sad to leave. I came back for Thanksgiving and then I was like, oh, I have to go back there. And it's not that I didn't like Stanford. It's just hard to be away. And then when you get a little taste of home, I literally like my mom's driving me to Burbank Airport and I literally had her pull. I was like, mom, I'll throw up. I'm gonna throw up. She had to pull over on the side of the 134 freeway just because I was like pit in my stomach about going back, leaving home
sure,
again.
Sure.
So, no, another thing we have, we love our family.
Well, and this is another thing we have in common. So I'm reading about a story that you were working on about LeBron James move from Miami back to Cleveland, and so your mother Jeanette, you'd always kind of give her the rough draft to get some notes. She's a screenwriter for children's TV shows. Yeah. Now, what shows has she worked on? Talk about mom a little bit and what she's done. Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating to me because I fancy myself as a screenwriter also.
Yeah, my mom, she wrote on All Dogs Go to Heaven. Do you know that? Like when they made a TV show?
Of course.
So it was a movie and then they made it a TV show. She'd write some episodes there. We chase our dreams that far. We will find and she was kind of like she was a dance teacher. Now we're going way back in the LA high school machine, okay? So my mom was a dance teacher at Westlake School for Girls, which is now Harvard Westlake.
Wow. Sure.
They merged. Okay. But this is before it was even merged. This was like just a girl's school. So she had like Jamie Lee Curtis as her student. You know, she had the girl from Heart, you know. She had like like Tony Curtis, you know, like Tony. She'd see him and she'd be like, hi, that's Tony Curtis right there. Oh my God. Right? Like all the stars sent their daughters there. And so she was a teacher. And then when she had kids, she stopped working. I think it was when she had my brother. She kind of stayed home and just was a stay-at-home mom for a few years. And then wanted to get back to work when we were, I don't know, 7 or 8, 9, something like that. And that's when she started writing. And she just like, I mean, I can't believe she just started out. She wrote a few scripts herself. She met contacts in the industry. She got on a show. She got on that show, All Dogs Go to Heaven. She's still writing. She's still writing. Yeah. She's trying to write a coming of age story now as a book. And then I'm like, mom, we should option that. Let's do it as a screenplay, you know? Like, it's good. So, I mean, everyone in LA, people come to LA with like Hollywood dreams, right? But my mom, this was like literally like, such a cool thing to do when you're like, she probably picked this up when she was 40.
Yeah.
You know, and then started out at 40 and with two kids. That's not easy to do.
That's amazing.
I'm laughing because I read something where you said to her, like, Mom, I don't think I'm going to be a writer. I think I'm going to get a real job or something to that effect. She said that's when she knew you're going to be a writer. You're just being rebellious. Yep. But is that something that you still do? Yep. You still bounce ideas off of Mom and still kind of keep her involved, do you? Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah, because the truth is, first, like, my mom and I are really close. I see her, like, all the time. She's always over. I have two kids now, so she's always over with the kids, too. But my mom knows story and she knows characters.
Yeah.
And when you're a sports writer, like, I think there's a lot of people who write about, you know, the X's and O's and what adjustments they're going to make. There's like news stories or whatever, but I do narrative. Okay. That's what I make my bread and butter on. And like, I develop good relationships with people all around the league. And I get behind, and like, what I try to do at least is to try to understand people and understand everything that they're going through. And was really involved in the whole story. Cause I think so much of what we lose today in the hot take culture that we live in, we lose that these are people. These are people whose dreams that we're talking about. And like, you know, I see guys getting criticized for this or that. I had to write something on the Bucks this year and like Adrian Griffin got fired, like 30-13 record. Right. And I had to go behind, you know, okay, what happened with all this? And I remember starting the story with like, you know, I had met the Bucks. I'd met John Horst and Adrian Griffin the previous summer. We had like a long get to know you conversation out at Shutters in Santa Monica. They were like in town for a week. Sure. And then I went over to UCLA a couple times. They were always practicing at UCLA and talked to Dame and Giannis. And they came into the season. Remember, the Bucks were supposed to be like the favorites and they made the big, huge trade right at the beginning of training camp. And I remember talking to Horace and he loved Adrian Griffin, like loved him. They came up together and he told me the story about how he named his dog after him. Like, I was like, you named your dog after Griff? And he's like, yeah, like we lived in the same apartment complex and we were riding the elevator and we were looking for a name for our dog. And like, and then I'm in the elevator with Griff and I go, Griff, that's a good name. And he's a good guy. Okay. And like, and that, you know, and it was like, I was like, Horace didn't want to fire Adrian Griffin. He loves him, you know? And And I think that that's something you got to convey in that story. Like people think about, oh, he got fired because of whatever, whatever. And like so much on the shows, it's just going to be talking about what did Giannis think or what's going on, how they playing Dame and Giannis together, whatever. But like the truth is, like these are humans. These are people who like waited their whole life to be like Adrian Griffin waited his whole life for a head coaching opportunity, and then he gets it, and then you know. They trade for Dame Lillard and half the team's gone and Drew Holiday's gone. And it's like, whoa, this is not the team that they hired him to coach. And now we're halfway through the season and they don't feel like they have forever to make this decision and they got to do something. And so like my specialty is sort of deeply reported stories that I learned from I've been doing it for a while. So I know a lot of people in the league now, but also like I try to treat people the right way. You know, you try to talk to them and understand them and see things from a human viewpoint as opposed to just hot takes and headlines.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I guess one of the penultimate examples of that is your work on Clipped.
Yeah.
And executive producer and how that came about. I think you were working another series when all that stuff happened and your editor is like, no, you got to leave that and get on this story because this is when the tapes came out. I watched a few episodes on Hulu. FX's clip. It's actually really, it's really interesting. They mentioned my name, I think, once. They said, yeah, Marcus Johnson broke his neck. So they're talking about the bad luck Clippers.
The bad luck Clippers, yeah.
So, talk about how that came about and that must have been exciting just to watch how it evolved from, you know, covering the story to a podcast 30-30 and then all of a sudden now, you know, you got it up and running. And I know that process, it's a difficult process.
You know, because you've done it, right?
Talk about that experience and just how, you know, the ups and downs and the excitement of it.
You know, it's interesting because I was covering this, it's 2014. You guys are all from here, so you know the scandal, right? You knew Sterling, right?
Yeah, of course, yes. too well, yes. Yeah.
So, you know, I grown up here, so I knew the Clippers. I never disliked the Clippers. Like I rooted for the Clippers, like Ron Harper and those guys, you know, Benoit Benjamin, it was also Ralph Lawler, right? Everybody loved Ralph.
Yeah, sure.
But like they were just, it was just Sterling. You couldn't get out of it. He couldn't get past him. you know? And so like, you just knew the history there. And then finally he starts doing the right things. He hires Neil Olshey and Vinny Del Negro. He gets Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan. They make this big trade for Chris Paul. Like they're doing things the right way. They're finally going to turn it. And the Lakers at that time were not very good. Remember, they're in the lottery the whole time.
Sure.
And it felt like, oh my God, at the end of all this, the Clippers are going to get some leg up on things. And so I had covered the Clippers. That was one of my first beats when I was at the Daily News. This is one of those ones where somebody left and they weren't going to hire anyone for the job. And I was like, can I do it? And they were like, yeah, you can cover the Clippers if you know, just the home games. They're not going to pay for you to travel anywhere. But if you want to do that after you get done covering that high school volleyball game or high school football game or something, go ahead. I was like, man, all right, yeah, okay, I'll do that. So I would like cover a high school softball game and like drive down to Staples Center at night. Like, nice. And like, you know, that's what you do, yeah, when you're coming up. You just, you know, cover three things at once. And I'd be writing my softball story during the first half. And I'm like, what am I doing? It's like a professional NBA game. Come on, you know? But I was just anything to get a foothold, anything to like, sure, you know, cover the league, whatever. But it was great that I did that because I knew the Clippers. Like, I knew the executives there. I knew Elgin Baylor, you know? I knew the people who worked there for years and years and years. And like, so when this story happened in 2014, I was uniquely situated to cover it. Like, I, you know, when a big breaking news story happens, that's not when you call people for the first time, right? Yeah. You need to have existing relationships. People need to know you and trust you. Nice. And because I had covered them for so many years and because I like knew them and I was around when nobody else was around, I think that really helped. And it also just felt like this was such a big story that like, what am I doing running off to go cover the Wizards? You know, like I was going to go try to write something about John Wall. And then I was going to go try to write something about it was the Blazers were winning that series. Blazers Rockets. So that's where it was when this tapes came out. And my editor was right. Like, he was like, look, this story is still going on. This is like international news. This is not just, yeah, you know, the tapes came out and whatever. It's like, oh, what are they going to do? Are they going to force them to sell the team? Like, how are they allowed to do that? Are the players going to boycott? And then when they Adam Silver bans him for life, then it's like, oh, who's going to buy the team? Remember when Oprah was trying to buy the team and Magic was trying, sure, to buy the team and like every, right? And so this was just a big giant story. And the more I dug into it, and the more I saw the weird, awkward love triangle behind it, the, you know, with Vistaviano and Shelley and Donald. And I really knew those players very well. Like, I knew Blake Griffin really well, Chris Paul, DeAndre, all those guys. The more I was just like, you just got to stay on the story. Like, this is the story. And everything, there's a new second round playoff game, you know, every year. There's a new feature to write every week that, right, this, there's only one or two of these kind of stories that come along in your career. And so they just, you know, my editor, I'll give him a lot of credit for that. He kind of showed me the light, guy by the name of Eric Neal. And I was like, yeah, you're right. And I felt weird not covering the playoffs, right? Like, games were going on and I was sitting at home and or whatever, but it was really good. And then I always thought it should be more than just me writing a couple of magazine stories. You know, yeah. I thought it should be like from the beginning, even while I was in it, I was like, this should be a movie or it should be a scripted series or something. And it was right around the time People versus OJ came out. Remember that show?
Sure, yeah, of course.
For sure.
And so that's what I was like, it should be like People versus OJ. Like, who's going to play Sterling and who's going to play Adam Silver and who's going to play Stiviano, right? And so I would pitch this to everyone at ESPN. I'd be like, come on, we should do it. And the ESPN doesn't do scripted stories though. They do 30 for 30s. And so our director of development was like, hey, we don't, if you want to do something like that's scripted or a narrative, you got to go to ABC Studios or something like that. But why don't we do it as a podcast, like a narrative podcast? Because that way, you know, it's like writing a book, but people hear you and they hear the story. So it was a really good idea. It was a lot of work. Tell you that it was right. Like 18 months of work to do that podcast. But it really showed everyone what I was talking about the whole time. Like, this story has so many layers. This story is so wild. Like, you can't make this stuff up. And, yeah. And then once you heard it on the podcast, then I had a lot of offers, you know, people came, a lot of producers came out and were like, oh, let's, yeah, now I see what you mean. And so the woman who called me her name is Nina Jacobson. She's from Color Force, which is the people who made People versus OJ. And I was like, oh yeah, okay. Like, we're gonna go with you because that's the show that I love that show when it came out. And this is like event casting. I know you make good TV. You know, somebody I know is going to do a good job with it. And that's kind of how it ended up at FX. But that was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It took five years to get it made. Writing scripts, casting, shooting, editing, all of that.
Well, you know, so I auditioned for a couple of parts in that. Doc Rivers.
Did you?
Because of the hairline. And then,
oh, you could have been a good doc.
Well, but then I found out who they had hired, Larry Fishburne. And yeah. I work with Lawrence. His first movie was Cornbread Earl and Me.
We did together
back in 1974. Jamal Wilkes, Keith Wilkes at the time, was Cornbread. And Lawrence Fishburne was this brilliant young 12-year-old actor from New York that everybody – and he was really, really, really good in that.
Yeah.
But the other part I had auditioned for that I thought I had a legitimate chance to get was the Elgin Baylor role.
Yeah.
That was Clifton Davis. Clifton Davis,
you know, got it.
Really good actor and did a great job in that. So it was all good. But
you could have got one of your assistant coaches jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. I should. Yeah. Well.
But those weren't. They didn't have too many lines. I thought they were going to give my guy
Alvin Gentry.
Alvin should have more lines.
Yeah, Alvin Gentry's character was pretty good, but Ed O'Neill was like
amazing.
Have they nominated? There's Emmy nominations.
We're in the next cycle.
Where's Barbara? You didn't talk to her yet?
I was waiting for you and Magic.
Magic's not coming, that fair-weather phony. Get in trouble. You'll see. No loyalty. 99% of the people you call friends.
We'll go on just the two of us, then. I'll help you apologize.
Are you insane? I'm not going on with you.
Okay, because he's got to have one. I think the show should be... gets a lot of consideration, but Ed O'Neill, man.
And right?
The lady who played Shelley. What was that actress's name?
Her name is Jackie Weaver. She's Australian. Wow. So when
what else has she been in? Where else has she been? I've never went in. What else has she been in?
Silver Linings Playbook. You've seen her in that.
Okay,
like,
okay,
you've seen her in a few things, but she's such a good... She's like the Australian Meryl Streep. Like she's been in so many things. She's so versatile.
Ah.
And when she read, I'll tell you, we went to the table read and she came in with the wig on, the Shelley wig, and she's 5'1" maybe. And she had the shoes on. She came in like full character and she started talking and I was like, oh my God, she sounds just like Shelley. Like, that's nuts. Right. I think all four of them should get nominated.
Yeah,
Bea Stiviano, Cleopatra Coleman. Holy.
Yeah, she was good. Right? Really, really good.
Really good. Good. And then your boy Larry's pretty good too, right?
Yeah, well, of course. He's How much did Doc Rivers I see his name as a consultant, but how much was he involved with Lawrence Fishburne and letting him know the ins and outs? We did Blue Chips a few years back, and Bobby Knight really worked with Nick Nolte on developing that character. Was Doc like that?
No, not that much. They got together for like a weekend. I can't remember who went to who. Like, I don't know if Doc went to Lawrence's house or Lawrence went to Doc's house, something like, but they definitely got together and spent some time together. But like Doc wasn't on set. I don't think he ever came to set. He was involved mostly with the writer of the show.
Right,
her name is Gina Welsh. And so when we first started doing this show, obviously it's based on the podcast and it's based on hundreds of hours of interviews that I did for the podcast, right? But not all of them make the show, right? So there's like so many, like, you know, you'll have interviews with somebody that's 2-hour interview and you use like 2 minutes of it, right?
Sure.
So they had access to everything. But I said to them, I go, listen, you know, one of the things that I feel like you can get a lot out of the podcast and the interviews, but like for this show to feel real, like you really need to talk to Doc. Like I wasn't in the locker room with him. I wasn't, you know, Doc and I know each other really well from a number of years, but like I can't call him and then relay his thoughts to you. That's inappropriate for me as a journalist to do. Like you need to set up your own relationship with Doc. And so, and I felt like, we had done an interview with Doc for the podcast, but it was like 30 minutes and they had a million more questions and he was really the central character of the show. And like, you just need to talk to him more. And so like, you can call him and ask him if he'll talk to you. But like, if I were you, I would set up your own relationship. So they did. I think they called his people and set it up, but I don't think he was really as involved with, he was not as involved with Lawrence as you think. Like I think they really just spent like some time together.
Well, the one thing I got to know, and then Chris, you can jump in right after this, but the sauna scene at Doc's apartment between Doc and LeVar Burton, was that artistic licensing taken or was that a real, did that really happen? Did he cross
It's
paths
artistic
with LaVar?
License to some extent, okay? So he definitely, he didn't have like, I don't think he had a real relationship with LeVar Burton, but he did have a few people that he would call a lot. And I do think they had a sauna at his apartment that he would see that ugly white guy in there. Remember that guy who comes in and he's like gross?
Right,
I think that's real. And then I think they were looking for a confidant for him. But then here's what the crazy part is. When they were trying to figure, they wanted, and because, you know, a lot of characters in this are composite characters.
Sure.
Okay. So, so V's friend, Deja, who I love that character, she's based on like, you know, three or four people, right?
Sure.
Or Shelly's friend, Justine, she's based on three or four real people. But they're just, you can't have three or four people. You got to put everything in one. You know how Hollywood goes.
Sure.
Right? So they needed a confidant for Doc. And I kept telling him, I go, look, he talked to Alvin Gentry a lot. You can have Alvin as the confidant, or you could have his mom. I know he talked to his mom. I know he talked to Wayne Embry. You know, he talked to Wayne a lot. And they felt like, I think they could have casted, they could have done that with Alvin. That would have worked. It would have been hard with his mom, because then you have to tell more of a backstory. You can't just like randomly have him call his mom, right?
Right.
And she's not a known person. And then Wayne Embry, that's another whole backstory you have to establish. So it's like everything is like you have to establish the backstory. So like, what can you do to have him have a confidant? And the writer's room was like, let's have him talk to another African-American man who's about his age, who's also famous. So like they can relate on in ways immediately. Yeah. And like Rembert Brown tells this story really well. I'll plug another thing. Okay. So I did a companion podcast to the show. It's called Let's Talk Clipped. Mm-hmm. And we have producers on the show. We have actors on the show. So you can hear Ed O'Neill on the show. You can hear him on episode 5 of that. It's like, you know, just reaction episodes to the to the TV show. Anyway, so Rembert Brown was one of the writers and producers. And he was just like Googling African-American actors between 45 and 65, you know, like even celebrities. And he just came up with LeVar Burton. And he was like, well, it turns out Lawrence Fishburne and LeVar Burton are actually friends, and they have conversations, like deep conversations all the time about race and things like that in the hot tub, in the sauna. Hmm. Like that's real. And Lauren, and they were like, Lawrence, why didn't you just tell us that? We would have just cast LeVar right away. But then it was just kind of perfect because they did have a rapport already.
Yeah.
Ramona, do you think that sort of the fallout from the Sterling episodes, the incident, do you think that had an effect on how owners build relationships with players and that dynamic? Was it already moving towards that, or was that definitely a turning point in owner-player relations in the NBA?
I think that was a huge turning point. I mean, look, I think owners have always had good relationships with star players, right? If you're a smart owner, if you're Jerry Buss, you're going to be friends with Magic, okay? Yeah. If you're going to try to develop a relationship, if you're Joe Lacob, you're going to get to know Steph Curry, okay?
Sure.
You know, the Bucks owners, whoever they may be, right? They change their minds, right? They're going to get to know Giannis. Like, but I think it's the Sterling episode really showed you, and it's something Mark Cuban even said, which is like the slippery slope of this, right? Mm. Used to be owners had a certain level of immunity. Like they had the power because they owned the team. They could just decide something and do it. You could be a scoundrel. You could have scandals, and you just kind of got away with it because there was no recourse for the league. There was no recourse for the players. And I think a lot of what happens in the Sterling story and in the story I tell on the podcast and in the show is anybody with a cell phone, man, like anybody can take you down now. Anybody catch you saying something you shouldn't be saying or something that if it was aired publicly would come across really bad. Like it's the great equalizer. And that what I think the players learn too is, like, they have a voice too. I mean, I'll never forget Baron Davis talking about how Sterling would heckle him. Remember when they signed Baron Davis Sterling sat courtside and,
"You're fat, you're fat, you're a fat, fat fatty. You're just a fat, fat fatty."
You know, and like only thing he could do was, I mean, I was proud of Baron for saying this, that he, you know, he went and talked to Mark Spears about it and they wrote the story. And I was like, good for you that you had the guts to do that. But like, most of the time players just kind of took it. Like I had so many stories of players talking about what it was like in that locker room. I'm sure you have a few. You know, yeah. what yeah. the way he would come in the locker room with his friends and kind of ogle the players and violate their personal space. I mean, this was the stories were like they never ending. Like every year, like we for the podcast, we talked to Darius Miles and Quentin Richardson and Olden Polonese. I mean, all the, you know, everybody from every era had a story or two or 4-10 of how they felt objectified or dehumanized. And, you know, Elgin Baylor, I think, is was the right person to tell that story about, you know, the plantation mentality in his lawsuit. Sure. And like, it didn't go anywhere. I think Elgin might have won that story if he didn't also sue the NBA.
Yeah.
That's what hurt that lawsuit.
Well, so Donald Sterling, so I had a tragic accident, lost a son in a drowning backyard swimming pool accident, Marcus Johnson Jr., 17 months old. So I run into Aileen Voisin. You know Aileen?
Yeah, of course.
Aileen. So Aileen, she's covering for the Herald Examiner. She reaches out to me. She's like, Marcus, I talked to Donald Sterling, and Donald wants you to call him. I was like, Aileen, I'm not in the mood to talk to Donald. I don't know if that's a good idea. No, he's really, really reached out and really wants to talk to you. Yeah. So I wound up calling Donald Sterling, and I'll never forget this. Ramona, I mean, I got on the phone and Donald just launched into how I was the worst piece of scum and I couldn't be responsible for taking care of my kids. And by the time he got through with me, my name would be, you know, worth absolutely nothing in Los Angeles. And this is because we were involved in a contract dispute and you'd better accept our offer. And it was like and I just got off the phone just like, you know, I tried to play it off talking to him, but I just got off the phone shook. And, and ever since that, you know, I haven't given it a lot of thought since we're talking about this, but Donald had so many stories like that. There were, I remember in a clip, there was the scene at the white party where he's holding Blake Griffin's hand and introducing him to everybody, but he's taking him by the hand and people are like, well, that's not realistic. I remember one of his Christmas parties. It wasn't a white party, but it was at the Malibu house. It was at the Malibu house. And there was our PR guy was named Scott. I forgot Scott's last name. He was a former Laker ball boy, but he came up to me and says, Donald wants you to take a picture with Santa Claus. I was like, okay, all right, whatever. And then I got there and Scott was like, well, he wants you to sit in Santa's lap. So you want all the players to sit in Santa's lap. I was like, Scott, I'm not sitting in Santa's lap. I'm a grown ass man. What are you talking about?
No.
But Scott was like, if I don't do it, Marcus, I'm going to get fired. Please, please. So I sat in Santa's lap and they took his hat off and palmed his head like it was a basketball and tried to look defiant, as defiant as I could as a 30-year-old man sitting in Santa's lap. But it was just a lot of crap like that, man, that you're dredging up old memories. I hate to digress into that realm, but so when it happened that he lost a team and V. Stiviano came out with the tapes and all that, I wasn't necessarily feeling a lot of now Shelley I liked Shelley a lot. Shelley was always cool, but when that happened with Donald, it was like, you know, it was just it was heading toward something like that with them because of all this past
action. It's been 30 years of stories like this. I mean, that's one of the worst stories I've ever heard, by the way, what you said about your son.
Yeah.
Like that's just terrible. Like I can't even describe how terrible that is. But everybody has these horror stories, and how does this go on for 30 years? Let alone, you know, the team sucked. Like they never made it out of the second round of the playoffs. Right.
Right.
So, you have this team in Los Angeles, and I had a lot of people had a lot of theories, right? Like, oh, well, it's kind of like nobody wanted to do anything about it because they don't want, you know, it's just an easy win every year, or they don't have to worry about him as a threat. But then also, like, well, they don't want him. If you look into his closet, you don't want anybody looking in your closet, right? Like people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. But I think it's also like he was an incredible litigator. He was an incredible lawyer, and he did own the franchise. So it's hard to get someone to sell something they own, like their property. Yeah. He saw it as property. And like, there was no way you could shame him into doing anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we try to get to in the show. That's what that's where Ed is. So I'm so glad you love Ed's performance. Cause like,
oh my goodness,
God, it was,
And it wasn't like he was trying to, you know, be Donald Sterling. You could tell he'd watched some tapes and interviews or whatever. He had the general kind of essence of Donald, but he put his own spin on it from his perspective as an actor, and man, just did a masterful job at that. So it was really good stuff. But again, talking about, and I'm, this is the last bit of Clipper stuff I'm gonna get into, because I don't want to stay here to negative. We pride ourselves on being a positive show, but the karma that came back on the Clippers in terms of, they talked about me in that show breaking my neck. I ran into Benoit Benjamin's stomach that ended my career. I broke my hand, my right hand, the very first day of training camp after I got traded from the Bucks. I was in line. We were doing a drill. I reached in. It felt a little awkward. I told Brad Greenberg, somebody's going to get hurt. You know, but this is the way we do things in Los Angeles. You know, this is not Milwaukee. No. The second time I went around, I broke my right hand. Derek Smith, the late, great Derek Smith, was right behind me. He reached in and broke the left pinky on his left hand in the same drill. And so that's when they finally stopped. But then you had Danny Manning. You had Sean Livingston. You had all the these Clipper players curse. That – The Clipper curse. Yep. And that's to me, that's kind of.
Didn't Lamar Odom break his leg or something? Landing on a basketball and layup lines?
All that stuff. So anyway, but that's enough. But congratulations on Clipped. And when this turn of Emmys come around, hopefully you guys will be right in the mix. And
hey, on my next show, we're going to make sure you get a part. You should have hit me up before.
You
hit me up. I want to put a word in with the casting director.
Well, I saw you were rep by CAA, and I was like, oh, wow, I should have hit her up. That's big time stuff.
For love of the game.
There's nothing like being selected to the Olympic team.
And love of their country.
Championship of that level, gold medal, means more.
Tune into Behind the Bucks on the Bucks Plus Audio Network. Inside stories from Bucks stars on the agony and triumph of competing to win it all at the Olympics. It's Behind the Bucks, presented by Gallagher, your trusted insurance broker and HR and benefits consultant. Available now on Bucks.com/plus, the Bucks app, and streaming wherever you get your podcast.
Listen, let's talk a little bit about the Milwaukee Bucks, since this is the Here District, the Milwaukee Buck broadcast.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the power rankings, which I always kind of see what the experts are thinking about this next season. They got Boston ranked number one. Okay,
you understand
that.
As they should be.
The Knicks at number two with the additions and bringing back OG and all that good stuff.
Might be a little high. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Number three, Sixers with PG and Caleb Martin and that crew. Number four, they got the Pacers. I was a little surprised at that. The Pacers, even though they did
win the playoff series.
But without Giannis, without a healthy Dame, they had the Bucks coming in at number five. So anyway, just talk
so
about.
I would put Milwaukee at. I would put them back at number two if I was doing those rankings.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. I think this is I don't want to say the last hurrah. Okay, I don't want to say it like that because I don't want to get aggregated or anything like that. No, I don't have any inside information saying they're going to break it up or anything that. But it feels like there's pressure on this season. Because of the age of the players, right? Because the core, I mean, Giannis is younger, but the other guys are older. Because of the injury history, because of how much they gave up to get Dame, and how much they're going to pay Giannis over the next few years, right? Mm-hmm. But it feels like this is a comeback year for them. They had a lot of injuries last year. They were never right. Yeah. Doc came in under very weird circumstances, never really got to put his staff in, never got to put his system in. So I think it's a bounce back year for the Bucks. If everybody's healthy, I think this is a bounce back, because we all had them as the number one team in the East last year. Come on, after they traded for Dame, don't pretend you didn't. Like everyone out there, okay? Right. Like we all had them as the team to beat, and they're still that team. And they didn't do much in the offseason. They just kind of added to the depth around, which is good. Taurean Prince is a good player, right? And but. You know, nobody's going to turn heads like they did with Dame last year. But all they really needed was consistency. They needed the big three to play together. And I forget how many games they actually played together. It was like maybe 10.
Not a lot. Yeah.
You know, with Middleton and Dame and Giannis. Also, little side note, which you probably have noticed a bit in the Olympics if you've been watching Giannis play for Greece. Sure. He's got a little mid-range game. He's been working on that. I don't know if you saw, I put a little cryptic tweet at one point during the finals. I was like, you know, Jason Tatum's trainer, Drew Hanlon, has just barely made it back to the game from Athens.
I saw your tweet.
Oh, wink, wink.
No. I saw your tweet. Oh, wow. I saw that. I caught that. Yeah. I caught that, Ramona.
So, you're going to have to, like, ask your own questions around that. It could be Thanasis. But I'm just saying, you know, check out Giannis.
Costas or somebody else. Well, and also Ben Baker has taken over in terms of his development. And you, if you remember Vin as a player, Vin had a lot of good kind of shake and bake, pull up jumpers from 15. And that's what Giannis had been working with Josh Oppenheimer, who I really respect. I love Josh. He's an LA guy. Went to, where did he go to school at? Chaminade. I think Chaminade High
School.
And, then
that's about my way.
Out your way.
Man, that's Josh, like 5 minutes from my elementary school.
So Josh was working on him with Josh, one of the best shooting coaches. Yeah. Josh is the only coach that Rick Brunson allowed to work with Jalen Brunson growing up because of their connection. And so, but Josh's thing is shooting. And I just think with Giannis, Ramona, you know, with Giannis, you just have to accept the fact that he's never going to be this great 3-point shooter, and just allow Giannis to be Giannis, do what he does. But the fact that you talked about that mid-range game, that's going to help his game a lot. That's where the playoffs get down to.
I think with Giannis, like, this is a revenge year. Like, that sucked for him not to be able to play in the playoffs. That sucked.
Yeah.
It was hard watching it. And we all knew he wasn't really going to, you know, like later on they were kind of, you know, pretending like he might come back or something. I was like, oh, he's coming back. Unless they would have won the series. Like, I think maybe the second round. It's too dangerous to play with something like that. Right. We saw what happened when you push the calf injury like that. Mm-hmm. But I think with Giannis, it's like, he's really don't let him get motivated. This is two straight first round exits. You know, what happened last time that happened? They won a title in 2021, right? Like when you start doubting him too much, that's when he turns it on. And I think if he can learn to play with Dame and not just on the same court as Dame, that's really going to help. They need to, you give Doc a whole training camp where they, and a whole year where they can work on the two-man game between them. Like, you know, he's still going downhill all the time. You know, it can't be like Dame's turn, then Giannis's turn. The Dame's turn, then Giannis's turn. It's got to be like, they got to make each other better. Like, look at, I think he should look at LeBron and AD and that two-man game that we've been watching in the Olympics. You know, Giannis and AD, like, at one point were seen as similar players, right?
Sure.
They came in the league about the same time. They were both stars at the same time. Giannis obviously surpassed him in terms of MVP awards, individual accolades and stuff. But look how LeBron plays with AD. Like,
they definitely got the chemistry. I mean, they have that symmetry, that chemistry of the big, the small, the guard, the big guy. They read each other's minds. And to your point, to your point about Dame and Giannis, at times it did seem like they were just on the same floor together, not necessarily playing together. That take my turn, your turn. I would love to see what happens this season coming up. Giannis with some more mid range, because that's going to open up other options.
Yeah, the pick and pop.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, and see, well, hot off the presses here. I got my cell phone. I texted Doc earlier, and he just got back to me. He just got back from Paris. Doc Rivers. He's talking about Dame Rivers being in amazing shape, great shape. He's healthy. Mm-hmm. He's really happy where he. So you talk about a revenge year. I mean, Dame Lillard averaged 24-25 points a game last year. Chris and I always have this dispute about if a guy averages 24.8, it's actually rounded up to 25. He's like, who made that up? So he's but in Dame's world, it was a subpar year. I mean, look at numbers look good, 25 and, and 7 or 8 or whatever it was. Sure. But Dame is another guy. You talk about Giannis in a revenge year. Dame, because he didn't work out last summer. He was worried about being traded, getting hurt.
Yeah.
He didn't work out like he normally does. And right now, this is what I wanted to hear from Doc, is that he is working his behind off. And between he and Giannis, they got a lot to prove.
And I also think, like, you know, if you look at the advanced stats, okay, Dame had a good two-man game going with Brook Lopez.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, in terms of pick and rolls, like, Dame knows how to play with Brook, but he and Giannis never quite developed that. And there's all sorts of actions that they can do. And, like, you know, I know I keep bringing up LeBron and AD, but, like, you can look at Steph and Steph and the way he plays with AD, the Steph and the way he plays with Bam, or the way he's, like, the big small game is not. Is there's so many examples for them to draw on. I mean, obviously Giannis likes the ball in his hands. He's good when he brings the ball up. When they play through him, Dame is really good when they play through him. So you have two ball dominant guards. I mean, a guard, Giannis and a guard, but you know what I mean? Point forward. Sure. But it's like, you don't have to trade off. You have to learn how to enhance each other. And, like, they have to be committed to it. It has to be a priority for both of them. Right, because they're both going to sacrifice a little bit doing that. But I think I've talked to Doc about this a lot too. Is like he's got to come up with different actions that they can just bread and butter plays.
Yeah,
that those two can go to. And they started putting them in. They started finding, but every time they would get comfortable, there's somebody get hurt.
Well, and I think that's why the additions on the margins will make a huge difference. I mean, between what Tari and Prince can bring in terms of a spot-up shooter, what DeLon Wright is a really good spot-up three-point shooter. And then Gary Trent Jr., I love him in terms
of
that catch-and-shoot toughness. I mean, I just love everything about that acquisition. So that's another good ad.
He had a lot of other options, too. I was surprised he was available for them.
Yeah. So, but listen, I want to ask you a couple more things before we let you go. This whole new player thing in podcast, Draymond and Pat Bev, and I mean,
you don't like it?
Well, how do you like it? First of all, and has that impacted your access to these players? Do they feel like we don't really need the middleman anymore? We can go straight to the public with our own stuff. I mean, is that had a effect on your job?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the two you name, right, with Damron and Pat Bev, right? Like, Pat was like, "Do you listen to subscribe to the podcast?" Right? Yeah. Wouldn't talk to you as you did.
Yeah, that was messed up.
Draymond, what's interesting with Draymond is Draymond's like a talker. So, like, I know I've covered the Warriors a lot over the years, and there'd be times where, like, you know how we're, as reporters, we pull guys to the side after the game, like, "Hey, tell me what happened there," you know, and you don't want to ask everything in the press conference. You got to have something different for your story. So he'll go and tell you something. And you're like, "Man, I got to get that story up quick because he's just going to say it on his podcast." like, "I got to get that up. Like, I'm losing my exclusivity here." But then I thought about it, like, well, I mean, I guess it's his story. It's his information. Yeah. Like, I mean,
They still give up the goods, though. They still give up the goods as long as they got that respect and that rapport that you talked about.
They save stuff. I do. I like, okay. I was, to be honest, I was surprised that Paul George didn't break his own free agency. Because he's got, he's got a podcast P.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I was surprised he didn't do, like, "I'm going to Philly," you know, like tweet it or do a podcast where he announces it that way. Because people were doing that before with the Players Tribune or on their own Twitter feeds or Instagrams, and they like to announce their own deals. But then I think if you realize, like, look, that's the way I try to look at it. Like, if it was my story, I'd want to tell my own, I'd want to have my say in it too.
Sure.
But there's also something to be said for, like, you really can't do everything.
No,
like,
no.
Like, I know how hard it is to make a podcast. I know how hard it is to write a story. I have no idea how hard it is to be an NBA player. I only see a tenth of what goes into it, right? And so, like, I just don't know how you have time to be a player and a great podcaster and a business. You know, like, you got to keep as LeBron likes to say, and I'm sure he got this from somebody else, you got to keep the main thing, you know? So you can have a podcast. I like getting to know guys on their podcasts. You know, I think they say a lot more. You learn a lot more. Like, if you cover the Warriors, you got to listen to Draymond's podcast. See what, like, I was doing a story on Draymond and Klay. No, I was doing a Klay Thompson cover story. And I remember he did an interview with Draymond Green on his podcast. And a lot of the things that, like, they said on that podcast were, like, research for me and how I was prepping for my interview. And I was like, "Wow, that's interesting." You know, because, like, Draymond's interesting on his podcast. I like listening to him talk about the game and how he sees things. I don't worry about the access of it, because if you're good, they're going to still talk to you. Like, it's still ESPN. Yeah. It's still – I've been doing this a while, so, like, people know I'm legit in the way that I treat people and the way I'm going to go about it. What frustrates me is this feeling like, "Oh, I don't have to talk to the media now because I'm gonna say it on my podcast."
Mm. Right.
You know, because, like, this is something I think, you know, old heads like you understand. Like, you guys don't have anything without the fans. I don't have anything without the fans. You don't have anything, right? Like, you need people who are interested in your sport, who follow the game day to day. I need them to tune into my radio show and my TV shows. I need them to read my stories. You need them to watch your games, go to your games and buy merchandise and buy tickets and stuff. And so, like, the number one, the best thing that we all have to do, like, it's always – like, about, you got to give people, you can't think that you're bigger than that. You know what I mean? Like, you always have to get down on the level of, like, I need to talk directly to the fans sometimes. I need to, like, and it can't just be like, "Oh, it's proprietary. This is my stuff," you know, like, assume they're going to find what you said on your podcast. Like, no, you do a press conference after every game, because the fans who are following you day in and day out are going to listen to that post game, and they want to know tonight, not 3 weeks from now when you talk about it. Right. And, like, I respect guys that get that understand, like, it's about having that daily conversation about the league, about the teams, and you got to participate in it. I got to participate in it. That's the whole business. That's the whole, it's, it's a game that you guys get to play a game. I get to cover a game. None of us get to have real jobs where we have to be, you know, right? Like, these are fun jobs that we get to have, you know, like you, right? And so I think it's, sometimes I think we all take ourselves a little too seriously, you know? Right? You know what I mean?
I'm a journalist.
Exactly. Exactly. Stop it. Nobody's forced. Like I am a journalist. No, I'm not covering the Middle East. I'm not covering presidential politics. I'm talking about basketball. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, let's relax here. Everybody just do a good job. Be grateful that you get to have this as your job and you get paid to do this. Like, this is awesome what we do.
Right. Have you been watching the Olympics?
Every night. Every night. And I already know who wins during the day, and I still watch it at night.
And now Team USA, did you have an opinion on the way they chose the team, or were you indifferent about the selection process? No Caitlin Clark, no Angel Reese, no Arike.
I'm a little more mad for Arike than I am for Caitlin.
Okay.
Arike, yeah. Ogumba Wale. You got to say that.
Wale. Milwaukee, Wisconsin's own. Oh,
That's right. Yeah. And you know what? I love that she took him down two times in a row in the All-Star game. That was awesome. I said it on the show. It's on NBA today. They were like, who you got today in the WNBA All-Star game? And I was like, the team that has a grudge. So there's Nneka Ogumike, who should have been on Team USA and got snubbed. And then she got screwed over because she tried to play for Nigeria. And they said, no, you already played too much for Team USA. And I'm like, I still think that's so wrong. I'm still bitter about Candace Parker getting dropped from the team.
Right.
What the heck?
What do you make of all the Team USA politics, the dynamics with Coach Oriema and the brass that runs that organization?
That's the women's side.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure there's politics on the men's side too, but on the women's side, I don't like that there's politics. The problem is, they're going to win by 20 or 30 every night, no matter what, right? They got three times as many good players as any other country, right? So like, you know, it might be close against a team, but they're still going to win by 20. Like, right. Yeah. And so like those roster decisions don't have consequences. On the men's side, like if you don't pick the right team on the men's side, you might lose. Okay. The rest of the world hasn't caught up yet in women's basketball. And so I think they can get away. Like I thought when the first, I know there's been a lot of, I came into the scene a little bit later, but I'll never get over that Candace Parker one. Like that was like, this is Candace Parker.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Like, how do you disrespect somebody like that? And where they tell her, you know, you could pull your name out of consideration to avoid the embarrassment of not making the team. And she was like, nah, I'm not going to do that. Right. And then Nneka Ogumike, oh my gosh, she's the head of the players union. She's like she's so like important to the women's game. And she put in her time. She played during the summers and the off years and all that. And like, you're going to not put her on the team? Like, what?
Yeah. Why aren't you in Paris? Why aren't you in Paris? Do you have a chance to go?
No, not this one. So the Olympic beat, you know, ESPN doesn't go that hard on the Olympics because it's an NBC joint, right?
Sure. Okay.
And so there's just like, there's a couple of gigs covering the Olympics and they're really hard. You like work, you know, you cover three events a day and pump out a million features and stuff like that. And it's on all the other sports. And then, you know, if you want to do the Team USA basketball, that's kind of like a job that gets passed down, you know, from person to person. But
you got to be
first was Mark Stein.
Oh, okay. You got to be grandfathered in.
So Mark Stein had the job. Then he passed it to Brian Windhorst. And I think like I'd have to get in line and then you'd have to do you'd have to do all the off years too. Like you'd have to be in Abu Dhabi and the Philippines and the FIBA championship and the world championship. And I got two little kids. Like it's too much time away from home in the summers when I'm already like spending a lot of time away from home.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, during the year, right? It's like, you know, like there was a time when covering the Olympics was like my bucket list. Mm-hmm. I was like, I love it. And I was at the Daily News, a good story. We can end on this if you want. But it's 2008. And I apply for the bureau that's going to cover the Olympics for the media news group. Okay, so that's at the time the Daily News was part of the San Jose Mercury News, and there was this Salt Lake Tribune, and there was like probably 20 papers around the country that were part of this big conglomerate, and they were going to have a bureau with like three or four reporters who were going to cover like the hometown stories, right? So like, we got an athlete from Utah. Okay, you're going to write about that one. And, you know, we got somebody from LA, then you write for the Daily News. Like, and I got picked for it. And I was like, I was almost out of the business at that point because I've been grinding, trying to get a step up, trying to get a promotion. And I was like, I just can't keep covering high school sports forever, like, and making no money. And I'm living in a one bedroom. And I'm like, you know, just I'm coming up on 30, yeah. You know. I would think I was like 28, 29 at the time. And like, you know, you that moment, that gut check moment in your career.
For sure.
You're like, I'm either going to make it or I'm going to have to pivot. And I had done an internship at KNBC, which was like the NBC affiliate. And I was like, I'm going to pivot. I'm going to go into news production. I'm going to be a producer. And I had like, went on ride alongs with Beverly White out here in LA. I don't know if you know her. She's in the show clip, by the way. I got her a cameo. Cause I was like, that was my girl. Like she was so good to me. I was like, I got to pay her back here, get her a little cameo in my show. So I was going to get a EA job, editorial assistant. And then I got picked to cover the Olympics. And I was like, man, that was a big choice. Like I had to say no to NBC because I had to stick around for the Olympics. It was like a whole year away and I wasn't going to give that up. So I sit around and I'm like, I was content with my decision, but it was still a hard one. Cause then I still wasn't making it. I was like the local columnist covering high schools, whatever. And like 6 months before the Olympics, I get a call from the lady and she goes, hey, I'm so sorry to call you like this, but I wanted to let you know as soon as we knew so you can make other plans. And she was like, you know, due to budget cuts, we're not going to have the bureau in Beijing. And I was like,
yeah,
what?
That's tough.
And I was like, I turned down a job because of it. Like, oh my gosh. And, Okay. But I had been so excited about covering the Olympics. Like this was such a bucket list for me. And I'd already been talking to all my softball friends. Like this was the last year softball was in the Olympics. So I was already planning on going a week early and like spending some time seeing China and then also going to some USA softball events. And I had already had so many plans that I was like, you know what? Let me see if I can use my credential and I'll do some freelance work. Like maybe I could freelance for the Daily News. Like I'll pay my way there. But I'll get payback, you know, doing freelance for us or for whatever newspaper will hire me. And that was my initial plan. And then after a while, they're like, nah, you know what? We can't have you do that either because of insurance reasons. If anything happens, like you're on our insurance. I'm like, killing me right now. Okay. I'm literally going to work for free. Okay, fine. And then I just said, you know, I'm just going to go as a fan. Because I just wanted to go. That was like my Olympic dream.
Yep. Yeah.
And I already had plans with my friends to go a week early. And so I just went. Like me and my friends from college, like we went. I just became this USA softball fan. Like I got to, like Mendoza and her parents were there and like a bunch of the girls I played with, Natasha Watley, Stacey Newman, all the UCLA kids, right?
Yes,
I was trying to give
you
some Tariah Flowers.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
They were all there. And, hang on. Here comes my son. Danny, say hi.
Hey, what up?
It's Marcus and Chris.
What's up?
Hey,
what's
hi.
Up?
Come here.
What's up, young fella?
Anyway, I should wrap it up on that, huh?
Yeah.
He's five.
Listen, Ramona Shelburne, this has been excellent. We appreciate you so much coming to Hear District this afternoon. Senior NBA writer for ESPN and also executive producer for Clipped. On Hulu, FX's Clip.
You got it.
On Hulu, and we hope to see you come Emmy night up on
Let's
stage.
Get all dressed up. Let's get dressed up. And you're in my next show, Marcus. Okay.
All right. I
I'll
appreciate
make sure you.
You
get in the next show.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you so much. Take care, little
guys.
Boy.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.